Okay, I see a green light, and I hear a little bit of speaker, so I think we're doing it right. It is a joy to be back with you guys again. I've been looking forward to this ever since we got it back on the calendar. I have so much to go through with you all and just a short period of time to do it. So we're going to jump right in. Originally, I'd love for this to be like a Bible class period, but I'm jamming two lessons together into one, so we'll see. If you have a question, if you see something, you have a question, feel free to raise your hand. If I stop and ask a question, I'll try to make that obvious, but otherwise I'm gonna be trucking. So this series of lessons came about because there was a church that invited me to do a meeting, I think back in the spring, and they knew that I had traveled to Egypt, and they wanted some lessons specifically on Moses and the Exodus. So this series of lessons came from a combination of a church's request and then the trip that our Appian Media team made to Egypt and Jordan last fall. So through the course of this week, you can see on the screen, we're going to be talking about Moses and these seasons of his life. And there are so many more seasons you could add to that. We're just going to focus on these top five. We're going to talk about his birth. We're going to talk about his humility when he left Egypt and fled. We're going to talk about Exodus 32 and Mount Sinai and the golden calf. We're going to talk about his role as a prophet to Israel. And then we're going to talk about the text there in Exodus 33 that refers to Moses being the friend of God. So those are our five lessons for the week. And just to share a little bit with you, we'll look at some photos here. So back in October of 22, I think that's right, the team made the trip to Egypt and Jordan, and we have not released that video yet. Hopefully in the next few months we'll be able to do that. But we went over there to try to understand better what the experience of the Israelites was. I mean, there's plenty of material that talks about the Exodus from like an apologetic standpoint, or a historical standpoint. There's a new one from a series called Patterns of Evidence where they're trying to talk about the historical location of Mount Sinai. Like, so we're not trying to duplicate any of that. That's been done. Really, we're assuming that it took place, and we're trying to think through what the significance of the Exodus was to the Israelites and the effect that it had on them for the rest of the Bible. So we flew into Cairo. You can see that little blue dotted line. This is a map my brother put together for his kids so they knew where he was every day when he wasn't home. We flew into Cairo and we spent several days there. We traveled north to Tel El Daba, and that is a location where they think the biblical Goshen was, so where the Israelites lived when they were enslaved in Egypt. And then we traveled down and spent some time on the Nile River, just a little bit south of Cairo. Then we took an overnight train all the way down to Luxor, and I'm happy to share some of the experiences from that overnight train. It was not glamorous and kind of gross. But we made it all the way down to Luxor, and Luxor was one of their super religious cities. It was a temple city that, like, every pharaoh who came along added on to the temple complex, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And there are a couple of places in Egypt that are like that, but Luxor is one of the best preserved. This little dotted line does not actually represent our route. We actually flew back to Cairo and then flew down to Sharm el-Sheikh in the Sinai Peninsula. So we went from Luxor to the Sinai Peninsula and then drove up to the base of what we're labeling Mount Sinai. It's one of the Sinai locations. It's called Jebel Musa, and I'll share a picture of that. It's one of the oldest traditional locations. There's another one that people think might be Mount Sinai in Saudi Arabia. I personally don't hold to that. I think this one's a more likely location. And then we took a ferry across the Red Sea to Aqaba. So when the Israelites made the Exodus, they crossed the western finger of the Red Sea. We were not able to do that. We crossed the eastern finger. So we crossed the Red Sea, just not anywhere near the historical spot. But you got the sense of crossing the Red Sea. And then Aqaba is in the country of Jordan. So there's a port there. You have to go through customs there. We traveled up into Wadi Rum, into the desert of Wadi Rum. And everyone in America has seen Wadi Rum, because Wadi Rum is where the very first Star Wars movie was shot. So when you find Luke on his home planet, off in the desert, that's Wadi Rum. You've seen it. There's so much more to it than that, but everyone has seen that. Then we traveled up to Petra, and most people are familiar with Petra because of Indiana Jones. Okay, the stuff that you see in Indiana Jones was not there when the Israelites came through. The Israelites actually came through Petra. Just outside of the historical Petra is where Aaron passed away and was buried at the top of a mountain. And so there's a historical site there. So we went to see Petra. We got to see the Indiana Jones shot, but it has nothing to do with Israel. And then we traveled further north, and we made it to Madaba and Amman. And then we traveled just outside of Amman is Mount Nebo, where Moses looked into the land of Israel and died at the top of Mount Nebo because he was not allowed to go in. So that was our trip. That was our route. So just a few photos from that. That was our team that traveled over there. I could rattle off all those names. You've seen several of those faces before, I'm sure. But we just make the point. Look, it's not just me that does this. It takes a whole team of people. Those are some of the shots. So that sunrise, that's a sunrise on the left, is Wadi Rum. So a lot more mountains. Maybe a more modern pop culture reference. The Dune series is shot in Wadi Rum. So like while we were there, the production team was there carting around big sets. We actually saw a big crane carrying a big set for the next Dune movie. The upper right is a gentleman who's the captain of a boat called a Fleca. That's the Nile River. And he's a multi-generational captain. So like his father was a captain, his grandfather was a captain, his great-grandfather was a captain. And one of his honors, something that he thinks is really important, is he is from southern Egypt. So historically and nationally, he's from the area where the important pharaohs came from. So like he makes a big deal out of the fact that he's from southern Egypt, even though he works in northern Egypt. And then this is a family on the lower right. We went to a mud brick factory and made some mud bricks. And as we were driving back, like most tourists don't go where we went. And so some of these people have never seen a white guy before. And so as we drove past, they were out in their yard making their bread for the next couple of days. They had some clay ovens in their front yard. And as we drove past, we're like, oh, there's a family doing something really cool. Let's stop and talk to them about it. And so we stopped the van and all of us jumped out. And a bunch of white guys and a bunch of cameras. And the husband was like, this is amazing. And his teenage daughter in the yellow shirt was like, Dad, you're so embarrassing. And so he wanted a family photo with all of us. And she did not want to be in the photo, but she wanted to be in the photo. So like she's there, but she's not. They gave us some bread and they were super sweet and very generous. But that's an authentic Egyptian family up in northern Egypt. This is part of the hike to the top of Jebel Musa, or one of the historical locations for Sinai. We're actually stopping to take a picture so we can breathe. the elevation change going up there is just ridiculous. Let me see. Let me get my stats here. So you're climbing approximately 2,500 feet in 3 miles. The parking lot is at 5,000 feet, and then the top is at 7,500 feet. And it's a pretty steep climb that just keeps switching back and switching back. And so what you're looking at on your screen is you see the trail kind of go around the corner to the left. It cuts back to the right and then cuts through that split in the rock, and then you wrap around the backside, and you wind up above my left corner. And so it switches back all over the place. After you get past to the end of the trail, you go up what they call the steps. So there are 750 steps from the end of the trail to the top. And that's what steps look like. So if you look here, That's a step. That's a step. Yeah. The steps are man-made. Steps are man-made. So like if you go on the Appalachian Trail or things like that and they build steps, they're not really stairs. They're just rocks that are kind of, they give you a step up, right? There's actually multiple paths to the top. There's one location on the front side and it's all steps. It's all steps. There are 750 steps here. The other trail has 3,000 steps. And it's called the Steps of Repentance. And I think it's because as soon as you get on it, you repent and come back down. So, that's looking down. Okay, so just to show you, our trail comes down and winds around down here, and then back around to the right, back around over here, and that's where I was saying it switches back like that. One of the things, that little green area down to the left, is an area that they attribute to Elijah camping there at one point. It's possible. But one of the reasons is to show you all the elevation change, looking down. But then to point out, you know, I'm carrying my backpack and they're shooting me with a camera. But then you've got the production guys and they've got their backpacks and their cameras and their microphones and their gear. And like, they're working really hard. And some of our other local production guys actually had some donkeys loaded up with gear. Some people used camels to get partway up and then they switch it from the camels to the donkeys. But we're trying to get all this equipment to the top of a mountain. And then this is us at the top, and that's what I look at all day long. Like, they're shooting me with beautiful stuff, and then I'm facing a half a dozen sweaty, nasty, smelly guys with cameras telling me what to say and do. But you need every single one of those guys. And then along the way, this guy in the goofy tan hat with the black t-shirt, that's another tourist. He's like, what are you guys doing? And they'll stand there and listen. And usually when they meet you, they're like, are you CNN? Are you with CNN? We are not with CNN. We actually spent the night up top. So what we were trying to do is we were trying to get footage of the sunset. And then we also wanted footage of the sunrise. And instead of hiking it twice, we just stayed at the top. And they have these little huts, no electricity, no running water, that they let people sleep in if you want. And we're like, it's gorgeous up here and there are no clouds. Can we just sleep out on this patio thing? And they're like, well, you can if you want. And we're like, yeah. So they gave us these little like 1.5-inch mats. Wasn't much to them. And then these wool blankets that are animal blankets. They've never been washed. And it got down like into the 40s, which was beautiful. But they're local to Egypt, and so they're like, it's freezing, we're going to go inside the shack. But we just slept out under the stars, and fun story, if you ever visit my house, when I make these trips, I like to pick up souvenirs, and after making so many trips over there, like there's only so many trinkets you can get that they sell all over the Middle East, they're all the same. And so I try to pick up things that are significant to my trip, that most people probably wouldn't care about. So I had to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, and the gift shop is open 24 hours because people are hiking up all times trying to get the sun. So I went to the gift shop and I said, hey, would you sell me one of the blankets that I'm using? And they're like, no one ever asks for blankets. And I'm like, well, I'd like a blanket. And they're like, you'd have to hike it back down. I'm like, that's no problem. And so he rattled off to him what was some crazy amount, which equated to like $5. And I was like, $5 for an authentic animal blanket that I slept under on Mount Sinai, I'll do that. And so that red blanket in the very front is in my house. And when Anna picked me up in the airport, like they were all so excited to see me. But like as soon as I got in the passenger seat, she was like, whew, you need a shower. And I was like, I showered this morning. I think it's the wool blanket. And she had to wash that thing like 3 times so it wouldn't smell like camel. those are the last few steps going to the top from the middle of the night. And then that's the sunrise. My buddy and I, Dan, got up like 4:30, 5 o'clock to get those last few steps and just sit there and wait. And we had our cameras and we just kept adjusting settings and taking pictures for like an hour. So we have so many variations of that photo, but it was gorgeous. Okay, that was all just like sharing and getting you there. If you have any other questions, like I said, we have tons and tons and tons of photos. There's more that I could have thrown in there. We could have thrown in some pictures of crossing the Dead Sea, or the Red Sea. We could have shown some pictures from Petra, both at night and the iconic, you know, looking at the treasury and things like that. Or overlooking the valley into Israel. We might share some of that this week. Really what I want us to do is to get into our text, okay? And start talking about Moses and setting up his story so we better understand him. So let's talk about that. That's actually the Nile River. That's one of those boats sailing across. Let's do a little bit of history and geography. What you're looking there is a geographic picture, a satellite image of Egypt highlighting the Nile River. And it is so confusing. Like, north is up, right? South is down. But when you're talking about Egypt and their dynasties, north is lower, south is upper. But you need to know, and I'll just try to refer to north and south instead of upper and lower, because that just, it gets confusing. It's different. What we're looking at there is a series of dynasties around the time that Moses was born. And so let's get another timeline up there. What went on in Egypt is, for the most part, the ruling class lived in southern or upper Egypt. So when I told you that boat captain had a sense of pride because he came from southern Egypt, that's because historically that's where most of the monarchies were. And they ruled from there. Very rarely did they go down to lower Egypt. But there was a period of time where some invaders came in from the Israelite region. It wasn't Israel at the time, Canaan. They came down from Canaan and defeated lower Egypt and kind of established themselves as pharaohs. And so they were foreigners trying to take over sections of Egypt. And so at the same time, you had competing dynasties in lower and upper Egypt. And the invaders were trying to claim that they were from Ra, that they really were Egyptian, but they weren't. And they were called the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, okay? And so they lived there, they ruled there, they wiped out so many of the Egyptian elites. And then after a while, the dynasties in upper Egypt, southern Egypt, are like, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're going to chase these shepherd kings out. And so there was war between upper and lower Egypt. And they drove out the Hyksos rulers, right? Now, around the time that took place, so you've got the expulsion of the Hyksos. And just on the left, you see some really interesting things. Shashu and Apiru in Canaan, those are phrases that are Hebrew phrases. And you're seeing them being used in Egypt to refer to these people from the Canaanite area. And then they kick out these Hyksos rulers. And there's a whole lot we don't know about them because it was like cultural cleansing. They came through and they were so frustrated with them. They were removing their statues and they were destroying their palaces and they were getting rid of anything that reminded them of the Hyksos. And it's around that time that you've got Jacob in Egypt down in 1876, way down here. Moses was born approximately 1526, sometime around the expulsion of the Hyksos. And then in 1446, you have the Exodus. So think about all of that in connection, and we'll circle that. The conquest of Canaan begins, and we're going to circle these phrases that refer to Hebrew people in Canaan from Egyptian sources. Think about all of that and about the time that Moses was born and what we know about his story. So you have these people from Canaan, the Hyksos. They've been attacking the Egyptians. The Egyptians are getting them out. They're shepherd kings. They have flocks and things like that, which the Egyptians don't. And then at the same time, you've got these other folks that came down from Canaan, which was Jacob's family, and they're multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. And they kind of look the same, and they have some similar traits. And so when you go to Exodus, and that's just a fun thing to throw up there. We'll look at that a little bit later. When you go to Exodus 1, and you look at the first several verses, you've got the genealogy of the families in Egypt, 70 people when they first moved in verse 5. But then verse 6, Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. You've just got more and more and more. And when you get to verse 8, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Have you ever been teaching Bible classes with kids and they're like, how did the Pharaoh not know Joseph? Because Pharaoh, well, then you have to ask, well, which Pharaoh from which dynasty from which part of Egypt? So Moses and his family, if you remember the map, they're in lower Egypt, northern Egypt, up around the Nile Delta in the land of Goshen. They're not going down south. They're staying up north. And they just keep multiplying there. You've got multiple generations that have gone on. And then you've got this southern Upper Egyptian dynasty that has now conquered all of that, and they're further removed, and they've chased out the shepherd kings, but you still have this population of slaves that kind of reminds you of the shepherd kings. So in verse 8, this Pharaoh, this new king who did not know Joseph, said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." So you've got this population group that's really similar to the one that you're defeating and kicking out. And there's a ton of them. And you don't want them to rise up and join your enemies. So you subjugate them and make their lives harder. And you want to keep them around because it's great labor. So what you get in verses 8 through 12, let's look at verses 11 and 12. "Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel." So when you're talking about Moses, we have an introduction to why the people, the Israelite people, are in Egypt. But then we've like four verses explaining the geography and history of it. We had to do all this extra work to give more depth to those four verses. But I think that makes sense. And then it gets worse. Verse 12, 13. "So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter." That's an important word as you go through Exodus, the idea of bitter. Eventually they'll have the Passover meal and they'll have bitter herbs to remind them of the bitterness of their bondage in Egypt. "They made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." And there's some possibility that the taskmasters, there would have been Egyptians, but they also would have elevated some of the Israelites to kind of give them a token, hey, if you're a really good Israelite, you too could be like upper middle class, right? But that puts those people in a really difficult position, and they're going to be disliked by all the other Hebrews in the area. Verse 15, that wasn't enough. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because of the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. You know, we're familiar with the story. I mean, we teach this to our kids. That Pharaoh got so concerned about the number of Israelites continuing to grow that he came up with a process to kill them off and to reduce their numbers, population control. And his thought was, the fewer boys there are to grow into men to make more babies, the better for us. So we'll let all the women live, but fewer men. And then you have these midwives. And there's so much I want to say about the midwives. The important thing is to focus on what the text says about the midwives. Verse 17 says they feared God. Again in verse 21, because they feared God, he gave them families. And they valued life. They let the male children live. So Pharaoh asked, why have you let them live? They did not feel comfortable exterminating and killing babies. And there's so much that we could say about that. So much we can say about that in our society and make application. Now, I want to say something really quickly. I am not justifying lying. And this text is not justifying lying. This text is celebrating life and the fact that these women feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. And that's the main point. This is not a text to try to camp there and say the ends justify the means. That is not what this is saying. Okay? But I think their answer to Pharaoh is comical. And you should chuckle when you read it. Because Pharaoh's like, what's going on? Like, you're supposed to be killing these kids. And they're like, look, they call us and we try to get there, but these women are so strong and hardy, like, babies pop out before we can get there. They don't need anesthetic. They don't need nothing. And Pharaoh's just like, huh, okay, well, then when they show up, throw them in the river. So what you've got is an introduction to the circumstances, the oppression of Pharaoh, and the death of the Israelite boys. And then in chapter 2, we're introduced to Moses' family. Verse 1, now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. Now, this is not their first child. We find out later, they're older children. Okay. There's something to be said about verse 2. Because when she gave birth to Moses, it says when she saw that he was a fine child. The parallel passage in Hebrews chapter 11 says when they saw that he was beautiful. Let's talk about that for a second. I love babies. Babies are adorable. I'm going to offend somebody. Not all babies are beautiful. They are not. You know, some babies, you're just like, whoa. They're going to grow into that, right? And their parents, every parent thinks their baby is beautiful. And they're like, oh, aren't they so beautiful? And they're like, they are such a great kid. I'm so happy for you. Vibrant. They're vibrant. They're healthy. So glad they're healthy. Please don't ask me to comment on the don't. All right? That is not what this is referring to. This is not saying that Moses' mom, and in Hebrews 11, Moses' dad, they look on him and they're like, he is the most handsome baby at all. It'd be a crime to kill him. That's not what they're doing. I think, again, this has to do with life. They look at their child and they realize there's potential here. We don't know what that potential is. He hasn't grown into it yet. We don't know what he's going to do. And we're not going to kill him. I think they would have said that about Miriam. I think they would have said that about Aaron. But they look at their child and they value life. That's what's going on. And when she realizes that, she actually does something really risky. She risks keeping him alive, because if she keeps him alive and she's found out, it is not going to go well for the rest of the family. So she's actually putting her life at risk, her husband's life at risk, Miriam's life at risk, to save life. And they try to keep him with them for 3 months. Have fun with that. Like, how do you keep a squalling, crying, noisy, tooting baby from being discovered? But however they do it, they keep this noisy little bundle secret for 3 months until it gets to the point where they can't keep him in the house. He's getting too big for that. And so they do what they're technically supposed to do. They put him in the river. So if someone's like, hey, didn't you have a baby? Yeah, we put him in the river. I mean, he's in a boat and floating, and he's like right over there with the ducks, but it's okay. They kept him alive. They kept him alive. And it wasn't just that they threw him in the water with this basket and walked away, because Miriam is keeping an eye on him. So there's someone watching him all the time. Okay? So let's pick up in verse 4. Really what we've got in verses 1 through 3 is the faith of his parents. Because Moses hasn't said or done anything yet. His parents have been making a decision. Starting in verse 4. His sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew's children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, you know, this Hebrew girl pops out of the reeds, "Hey, shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse this child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Moses means to draw out. Okay? I just think about the providence of God in that whole thing. The mechanism that was supposed to kill Moses was the mechanism God used to deliver Moses. So what Pharaoh was going to use for death, God used for life. And how providential of God, like, it's not ironic, it's providential of God, that Pharaoh's daughter is the one that finds him, and she's like, "Oh, how cute." And she can't kill him. I mean, really, she should have flipped the basket over and let him drown. She knows who he is. He's a Hebrew. And she cannot be dumb. Like, as soon as she pulls this Hebrew baby in a basket out of the river that's supposed to be dead, but he's not, and a little girl pops up, she's like, "Oh, hey!" And she's like, "Aw." Yeah, like, if she was a cynical, mean woman, she would have killed both those kids on the spot. And when the girl's like, "Hey, I know someone, like, I know someone that could be nursing that child." But instead, that whole thing works out so that Moses' mother gets him back. Because she gets him back in her house, and she doesn't have to hide him anymore, and she's allowed to raise him for a season and continue taking care of him in her home with her husband, with his siblings, until he's done nursing. I mean, you all know how formative those first few months and years are. And Moses' family gets him. And not only that, like, it's reverse parenting. They get paid. Like, I did not have anyone offer me a check every single time my wife and I had a child. They're like, oh, you're going to raise a kid? Here, have a monthly allowance. It actually went the other way. I paid more. But instead, Moses' family gets paid for taking care of him. That's how well God's providence has worked all of this. And they didn't do it for that reason. They had no idea how it was going to shake out. I mean, the truth is, they should have anticipated death at every turn. I mean, they were doing what was right and anticipating punishment. Now, let's make a really neat connection, and we're going to fly through this part really quickly. But this is a process that we're going to go through every single lesson this week, okay? Later on in Moses' life, in Deuteronomy is a collection of five sermons that Moses preaches to the Israelites before he dies. The Israelites, the second generation after the Exodus, are ready to go into the land. They're back up there for the second time, waiting to go in. And Moses is like, if I could only preach five more sermons, what would I preach? And so he preaches five sermons. And in one of them, in Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 15, he says this, the Lord will God, he's prophesying, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. And it's one of the many prophecies about Jesus. And so he tells the Israelites, before they go in for the conquest of Canaan, he says, at some point in the future, God is going to raise up another prophet, and he's going to be like me. And when that prophet shows up, you had better listen to him. And I would add, you'd better listen to him better than you listened to Moses. Okay? So when you look at history, and this is a really small chart, it looks great on that big screen. It looks great on a computer screen. You've got Genesis 1:1 and the creation on the far left. And you've got the creation, the fall, the flood, Tower of Babel, right? And you might even say that, you know, creation, corruption, catastrophe, and confusion. And then you work forward and you've got post-flood. You've got Abraham, Joseph, Moses is dropped in there, Joshua, Saul, David, you're into the kings, the United Kingdom, the kingdom divides. You've got the exile, and then they're brought back to the return in the 500s. And then you get to the birth of Jesus, and you keep working through all of that, okay? Up to us. We're over here on this side of the cross. But Moses falls in line there, and Jesus falls in line there. And let's talk about Jesus for just a second. When you go to Matthew chapter 1, and not just in Matthew, Luke has an account of this too. When you go to Matthew 1, the bulk of it is a genealogy of Jesus. Like, this is how we got to Jesus. Kind of like at the beginning of Exodus. This is how we got to the Israelites being in the land. They both start with, this is how we got here. Okay? And you can read all of Matthew 1. And then when you get to Matthew chapter 2 and the first 12 verses of chapter 2, we're introduced to this really ungodly man, Herod the Great. Matthew chapter 2, and I'm going to jump forward there in my Bible. Verse 1, this is after the birth of Jesus. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Herod is oppressing the Israelites. I mean, you can read so many passages in the New Testament about the horrible things that Herod the Great did. He was killing Israelites. He was a horrible guy. But he was insanely jealous, and he was afraid of someone competing with him for his crown. And so he was super nervous when he heard that there was a king of the Jews that had just been born fulfilling prophecy. And then you've got the faith of the parents talked about. In Luke 1, Matthew 1, and Luke 2, you have these parents that choose to give birth to Jesus. It's a tremendous amount of faith. The things that they do. You think about Mary and the faith that she had to give birth even though she wasn't married. And how that would have affected her reputation, the stigma that she would have carried. Think about Joseph choosing to marry her and make her his wife even though he knew that child wasn't his. And the stigma that he would have carried. Just like Moses' parents, Jesus' parents had a great degree of faith in choosing to have Jesus. There's some really neat places that you can go in Israel and see places significant to that. This is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. This is when you walk in. This is on the traditional site over which they think Jesus was born. Stone manger in Israel, similar to what Jesus would have been laid in. But then when you get to Matthew chapter 2 in verses 13 through 15, after the wise men have departed, they haven't gone back to Herod. They have not told him where the baby is. Verse 13, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." And so Jesus has this little sidebar where he goes down to Egypt, lives there for a few years until Herod dies, and then comes back. And what this is saying is, it's like Jesus had his own mini exodus. He went down, he was fleeing for his life, and then God delivered him and brought him back into the land. Really, really neat connection. The deliverer was delivered. I think that's a neat way to say that. And we're not sure exactly of all the route that he took. There's a lot of speculation about that. There are actually some sites in Egypt, traditional locations where they think Jesus stayed, and you can visit some of those places. But then you keep reading, Herod is so furious in verse 16 that when he saw he'd been tricked by the wise men, he became furious, sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. And this fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. You've got Herod doing something similar to what Pharaoh did. Different reasons, but they end up killing a bunch of boys. And there's actually a place under the floor of the Church of the Nativity. The Cave of the Innocents is in underneath the floor of the Church of the Nativity. And they have found little tiny coffins, they're called bone boxes, or ossuaries, of toddler and infant boys. They found them there. And it fits what the Bible describes. So just like Moses, Jesus survived the death of his generation. God providentially saved him. And all of that is because of what God did. He returns in verses 19 through 23 of Matthew 2 because an angel tells Joseph, "Hey, you can go home now. Rise, take the child, his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who sought his life are dead." And so he arose and took them, right? And eventually he goes up into the land of Galilee. He goes to Nazareth in verse 23 and fulfilling prophecy again that he'd be called a Nazarene. He lives out the rest of his formative years. Okay. So what we're trying to do through the course of this study is we're trying to see the connection between Moses and Jesus. And so just really quickly, every deliverer God raised up pointed to our ultimate deliverer, Jesus. Moses was a deliverer. Moses pointed to Jesus. God is providentially working through history to accomplish his redemptive plan, and he plays the long game. We need to be patient and trust him. God was providentially working through Moses. God was providentially working through Jesus. And Moses pointed to Christ. An underlying lesson from both of these is that the life of every child is precious to God and should be precious to us as well. And we want to follow the example of both sets of parents and live by faith, no matter what the personal cost may be. There's going to be a cost, but it's worth the cost to help your children come to faith. Okay? So we flew through that. I think we're a couple minutes late. Thank you for your patience, and we'll get started with worship here in just a little bit.